Before we get rolling, a quick note that while there are no mature topics in this episode, it does feature colorful adults using colorful language, so maybe don't play this one around the kids.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Hello, world. Welcome to Living to Write, where we talk with notable writers about their methods, journeys, and advice for other writers. I'm Brian Landwehr. I'm a writer, and if you are too, or just want to learn more about writers and how and why they do what they do, you're in the right place. And with me each episode is my wingman, Bailey Patterson, who is himself a talented writer as well as producer of this nifty little podcast. Hello over there, Bailey.
Hello, my good friend Brian, and hello, listeners, and hello to our little nifty podcast.
It is nifty, isn't it?
It is nifty.
I think it's going well so far. I think this episode in particular is going to be very nifty. Here's the deal with this one, listeners. In this economy, you can't afford not to listen to this one. It's a bargain. It's a BOGO. It's two for the price of one. We're following up our first two-part episode with our first two-guest episode. These guests are a writing team, and they're kind of a big deal right now. Please tell everyone who you found for us today, Bailey.
If you pulled their IMDb pages, I mean, you honestly couldn't tell where Doug Mand ends and Dan Greger begins. They're basically the same mind with two driver licenses. Together they've been writing comedy for years, sketch, TV, features, and now they're the guys trusted with reviving the Naked Gun.
Yeah.
A massive beloved franchise with one of the most iconic comedy characters ever, and they've been tasked with not just honoring that legacy, but to make it feel fresh in the era of 2025.
The new Naked Gun movie has been very well received, and it's certainly in the spirit of the franchise, and I've enjoyed this franchise all the way back to the original 1980s Police Squad series. Dan and Doug, as you were saying, are somewhat attached at the hip professionally. They've had a bunch of success as a team over the years. Executive story editors on How I Met Your Mother, and there's Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Chippendale Rescue Rangers, and so this should be a lot of fun.
Writers so inseparable that if you ever tried to split them up, well, in the words of Liam Neeson, they will find you, and they will kill you.
Very impressive impersonation. but let's maybe leave the comedy to the professionals here, so...
Ouch. I do write horror. You are right. Let's get them in here, damn it.
Yeah, great. Dear listeners, we now give you the writers of The Naked Gun, Dan Greger and Doug Mand.
Lights, camera, action.
Hi, guys.
Well, hello, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Hello, Doug.
Hi.
Hi, Doug.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, guys.
Of course. We
really appreciate this. We love nerding out with other writers, if you will allow us.
Please.
Congrats to both of you on the success of Naked Gun.
Thank you so much.
I am happy to see this form of comedy back in style. It's really nice. And I have lots of questions for you about that. But let's just get the non-softball question out of the way, which is... Why are you writers? Why would you do that to yourselves? Why in the world?
My father doesn't love me enough, and I need to fill the hole with other people's laughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does it work?
Briefly.
Yeah, and then it's on to the next project.
And on to the next hole.
Oh, sure.
That's a great pull quote.
On to the next hole.
I'm probably a writer because I met Dan, honestly. I thought that I would be an actor. I was acting a little bit, and then I met Dan in college, and I was taking writing classes. I was interested in it. I met Dan, and I walked headfirst into it. I had done some sketch comedy at my first college. I transferred to NYU. I ran into Dan on the street. We had met in a writing course a year before. We ran into each other. He said, audition for my comedy group. And I auditioned as a sketch group, and I auditioned, got in. And then I quickly learned that it's like, waiting by the phone as an actor is the most brutal thing you can do. And we came up at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater And it was a very DIY vibe. And at the NYU Film School, very DIY, just like go out and shoot shit, make films, make sketches. And so it was a real write your own material thing. And so I found myself writing out of necessity at first. And then 20 years later, I'm still doing it. And I was lucky enough to learn how to do it on the fly with someone like Dan and other very intelligent people.
So very little writing for you until you met Dan?
This is at age 20. I mean,
not
even as a hobby.
Not as a hobby in high school. It didn't come easy to me. That's for sure. Like lots of learning disabilities, I always felt like the barrier to get in as a writer was really high. So don't even try in some ways. I liked reading. I liked novels and stuff. And then I really liked performing sketch comedy and writing my own stuff then for that.
I think that was a big part of, as our sort of careers converged in this sketch group called Hammercats at NYU that we sort of started and it's still there today. The big thing about coming up as a sketch comedian, as an improviser at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and at NYU was just the understanding that you're especially at that stage, you are your own best advocate.
Mm.
And no one is going to take your work as seriously as you take your work. And so you sort of have to be a jack of all trades. You have to believe in it enough that you're willing to go be the producer who go picks up all the props at Target. You need to be the cinematographer. You need to be the director. You need to be the writer. You need to be the actor. And you need to be the casting agent. You need to be the wardrobe. You just do it all. And that sort of necessity to be responsible for everything is the best education that you could ever get. I mean, it's just the making of the thing is how you learn what goes into it. I'm continually struck by I actually just heard Zach Kreger say this also. He came up as a sketch comedian in the same
Zach era. Like back in New York, doing the same stuff. And he was a successful actor for a long time, just acting. So
from White as Kids, and we were all around the same community of sketch comedians around New York at the same era. And I just heard him say this, which is exactly true, which is like the lizard grows to the size of its cage. And that's what production is, which is like, if you're making a short film for $150, you are going to be stretching that $150 to the absolute maximum. It will always remain a race against the clock. You never have enough time. You never have enough of anything. And then you get, got eventually to make a movie for $1 million, $2 million. And it was the exact same thing. And then we get to make a movie here in Naked Gun for, 40 some million dollars. And it's the exact same thing. There's never enough time. There's never enough money. You're always up against the exact same pressures. So the lessons you learn from making the thing for $100 are literally the same experience in so many ways of making it for 40 million. It's crazy.
It doesn't necessarily ask why writers, because being a writer, actually sitting down and writing on a blank page is horrifying and it's the worst. And I wish I didn't have to do it a lot of times. So that is like, there's like, I'm like, man, I just wish I fucking understood real estate and like fucking rented people houses or that brought me joy, but I do like creating stuff. So I think both of us are coming from the place of like, writing also is a means to producing and making things. And so it's not just love of writing, but it's love of creating, stories and telling stories and then doing all of those things. And, to this day, whenever I meet a young actor, one of the first things I say is you start writing too. Like, and don't be taken back by, I don't know how to write. Like, you know how to write. You do. You know how to write and you'll work through it. Not, and that's not saying you'll be great. It'll suck at first, but like everyone I meet in LA who's coming to be an actor, I say, start writing, find your people and start writing for yourself now. And I don't think anyone listens, but I say it.
Well, it does sound like really smart advice because not everybody is going to be stellar at it, but at least don't let it be your kryptonite. Make sure it's not that thing that you run away from.
There's no downside to it.
I love both of your rich answers about why be a writer. in that both of you talked about storytelling and craft and industry adjacent things beyond that, because I do worry about writers who have great ideas and they do know how to use the language quite effectively, but they've never done anything but sit at a desk and write, and they've never touched any other aspects of storytelling. That seems like a gigantic disadvantage if your goal is the screen.
Well, we're not in the document production business. We're in the movie business.
Yeah.
And like, and that's the, it's, you know, it's so, it's one of the hardest parts about being a writer and being a working writer is the amount of times you feel like you're writing into a waste paper basket. And you have to be writing for the belief that this is a really going to be a movie. This is really going to get made. And the only way to, you know, and it's important. I mean, like during the strikes, I wrote a play, you know, and then I put it up.
Oh,
because it's a play, and you're like, all right, let's just do it. And it's so important to just write a scene, go film the scene. We got cameras now for dirt cheap. Just go make it. It's like so much more valuable to go make a thing and fail at it and figure it out and work on it than it is to like have a billion scripts that are going to just collect dust on your shelf. And that's not to diminish or discourage writing and writing a lot, because it's the only way to really get good. But like the process of actually turning your words on paper into produced material, no matter how small, is really the biggest, best education I have ever found to learning how to really write.
I mean, that was a gift. And we bring up UCB. Look, obviously we had this in us, maybe innately, to go out and perform. But when I say meet your people, like I really mean it. Like if you sit in your room all day and you write, that stuff's not going anywhere. It's just not. No one's reading it. No one's giving you thoughts. You haven't met anyone who has some sound equipment. You haven't met anyone who's got like a location to shoot at. Like then it's just going to live there, and you're in a vacuum, and you're not going to get better, and it's not going to get made. And I think one of the advantages that Dan and I had is that because we were performers and because we were a lot of like, just go out and get it. Once we got into the rooms, we pitched the shit out of things.
Yeah.
We acted them out. We performed them. And that did put us ahead of a lot of writers who aren't naturally that. And that's not to say that there aren't brilliant writers who you put them in a room of people and they clam up. And that sucks. And they have to find different ways. And their writing has to be that much better almost. And they need to network that much more. So someone's got to read it and do it. But so much of us breaking into the industry and then staying was getting into rooms and being like, we're not fucking leaving here until we get them to bite on something, and dancing and singing our way into like and group mind. And if that idea is not working, we quickly maneuver to something else. And luckily, as we've gotten more success, we've been able to stick with our original ideas a little bit more and go, you know what? No, that is what the idea is. But in the beginning, it was beg, borrow, or steal to be like, oh yeah, no, we've got ideas for that. We've got five ideas for that right now. And we would be prepared. And then we could tell if that wasn't going well, and we would just pitch the shit out of it and just sell.
Yeah.
And we were really, and look, that's fortunate, but it was also really hard work. And that's from years of grinding in the basement of a Gristiti's supermarket, like performing.
That's where the theater was. That's
gotcha.
We weren't just the meat comedy best lives in a supermarket, a basement with rats and the smell of piss and old meat. But it worked. It was our
steel sharpens steel.
Right. So how did you two end up on The Naked Gun? Were you part of spooling up the project from the beginning, or were you approached with it at some point, or were you trying to get a hold of this project?
This was truly as a lifelong spoof movie, particularly Naked Gun super fan. It was a shocking dream that it came honestly into our laps. Doug and I previously written this movie called Chippendale Rescue Rangers for Disney, and
fantastic.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. We love the movie. The director of that movie, Akiva Schaffer, you know, we developed a really great working relationship with Akiva on that movie. And you know, when that movie came out, it did pretty well. Paramount had approached Akiva about coming on to direct this Naked Gun movie that you know, and Akiva immediately said, let's all do this together. And so you know, in a genuinely spectacular way. We started with, the property and Liam Neeson. Liam Neeson was attached already. And so that really, for us, defined the whole project. It was like, okay, Liam Neeson, Naked Gun, that sort of defines a really, to us, what felt like a very clear path forward, which is like, we're not trying to replace or beat those old Leslie Nielsen movies, which are genuinely perfect still to this day. That first movie holds up stunningly, which is a near impossibility for comedies to hold up that well over time. And but it felt like to us, well, we can do something different that still honors the spirit of the movies, but is our own lane for it. That is, you know, a take on the last, you know, 30 years of action movies that haven't been spoofed since the last Naked Gun. And so, you know, the genesis of it was, again, as working writers in Hollywood, it's rarely that straightforward and simple. But, you know, it came on a platter, really.
This one was a real, like, holy shit, I can't believe this is happening the way it's happening. And it's, you know, but I don't know how in the weeds you guys want to get on, like, the business and what leads to what.
Oh, we love weeds.
Well, oh, great. The very short history of this is that 10 years ago, we had a meeting at Disney saying, are you interested in Rescue Rangers, Chippendale Rescue Rangers? And we said, no. Why? And they're like, come in. Like, because we weren't assholes, but we were like, yeah, yeah. Does that need to be remade right now or rebooted? And they were like, pitch us anything. Just see what we say, maybe. And we pitched them this take. And we had this idea about kind of a LA Confidential, Roger Rabbit kind of noir take on fame in Hollywood. And we pitched it to them. And to their credit, they loved it. And our producers at the time, Mandeville, loved it. And we wrote it. And the whole time we wrote it, we were just writing it with each other and being like, well, they're never going to fucking make this, but whatever. Okay. And we finished it and everyone loved it. And then it was dead. It sat on a shelf. It was never going to be in the theaters. And for years and years, it was dead. And then the producers never gave up. They gave it to Akiva Schaffer. And then Disney Plus was created. And those two things created like a path for it. Akiva was like, I like this script and I want to engage on it. And we met him, loved him. And then Disney was like, we love Akiva. And because we don't have to put it in theaters and spend double the money to get it out there and doesn't have to take up a weekend that a Star Wars movie is coming out, maybe there is a path. And we made this movie. Without that movie, which is a fucking miracle that it happened, you know, that led to Naked Gun. It led to our relationship. It also gave us more credibility as working screenwriters. And then it allowed us for Akiva to be like, I want to work with Dan and Doug, and Paramount to be like, yeah, take them. We love that movie. And so that getting Naked Gun in so many ways was easy, but it was.
Yes, it came from a handful of miracles over 8 years.
Yeah. And with Rescue Rangers literally being dead and on a shelf collecting dust for years.
Its own subset miracle within that. I mean, randomness is like the, you know, if you've ever seen Rescue Rangers, there's a side character that Tim Robinson plays called Ugly Sonic. And it is basically a spoof of Sonic the Hedgehog, except
what happened. I mean, they made the first version of Sonic that came out.
Yeah.
They released it, horrified people. And they were like, they went back to the drawing board. So,
oh yeah.
And so we made a character, right, that was like just a disgusting reject of a Sonic the Hedgehog. And he's repugnant. I mean, that various iterations of the script, he had hairy blue nipples. It was awful. And so anyway, that particular character really resonated, really stuck in the craw of Paramount, who produces the Sonic movies. And we took a meeting with Paramount, and like, they were clearly a little negged by Ugly Sonic's existence. And like, I think it got them like that much more invested in like, well, okay, cool, but like, why don't we hang out? And so I think we were even more like on the hook for them wanting to work with us. And again, totally random. That only exists because Disney at some point rejected having Jar Jar Binks be the weirdo loser working at the Comic-Con. And so a lot of random dominoes have to fall in place for us to walk through the front door of the Naked Gun.
Wow, very interesting that a very clear line can be drawn through that many years.
Yeah.
But everything you do and get an opportunity to tackle is a result of everything you've done.
And nothing is ever dead. And I would say nothing is ever dead. And that's an important thing. You have to let it go. Like, you know, you write Rescue Rangers and then you're like, oh, people really like it. Maybe this will go. And then it's like, oh, it's dead. It's not going anywhere. You have to let it go. But good scripts do live. And good ideas
always find their way back into.
And good ideas find, exactly. Your good ideas, like, they find their way back into other scripts.
I mean, even more back in the process
too. Yeah.
Rescue Rangers was originally a concept we developed to take as a pitch for the Hardy Boys, which is another. Right.
Wow. Another
ridiculous, stupid.
I don't know that we ever really talked about that publicly, but that's fine. But it's a good lesson. No, it's fine. It doesn't matter.
The Hardy Boys.
When you break into the industry and you have these things called open writing assignments where there's a property we want to make and then they're like, hey, what's your take on it? Which is basically saying like, fucking break an entire movie for free. And then come pitch it to us, which is so hard.
Pitch it to us in a way that we still retain all ownership for. So like, you know, a lot of times you go out and you're like, oh, I'm going to go pitch on, you know, the Slinky movie, whatever crap. And then you're like, you leave and they're like, no, we don't like your take on the Slinky movie. Well, a lot of the times you're like, well, what the fuck else am I going to do with this Slinky idea? Right. You know, like I can't, own the Slinky. They own Slinky. I can't go take Slinky somewhere else.
Yeah.
Whatever. So it's like nonsense like that. But this, you know, but nevertheless, to Doug's point, like, you know, this is just a bad example, but you work on the Slinky idea. They don't want the Slinky idea, but suddenly like it actually cracks in your head, like a certain relationship or story or concept or area that is actually really exciting to you and interesting. And suddenly you're like, well, actually like that area is something that I want to explore elsewhere. And so you walk into other rooms and you're like, that's something I'm interested in. And eventually like that finds a marriage and it can be really fruitful because it's part of the just idea exploration that is writing.
Right.
So the two of you are obviously an incredibly successful team, but how does it actually work in practice? How does the craft work for you two? Do you literally sit in a room together and spitball a lot? Do you pass pages back and forth for rewriting and rewriting and rewriting? Do you tackle different parts? Do you each apply certain sensibilities to certain areas of the challenge? What's it like?
I write the sex scenes. Doug writes everything else.
I would have guessed that. I would have guessed that. Yeah.
And I won't even read them. I like going. I think, you know, it's something that's developed over the years. Generally, we try to get into a room together, even with Zoom. I'd rather be in a physical room in the beginning of a project.
Yeah.
We talk about it. We break out, which is, you know, we try to outline it beat by beat. And, you know, that can take anywhere from a couple weeks to a month or whatever based on our schedule. And then we go off and we split up the script.
Well, a really important step I will say in between there is that we write a vomit draft.
We write it. Well,
And I actually think that's one of the most important things. And as we've gotten further in our careers, we've sometimes been lazier about that or not. And sometimes we'll just be like, yeah, let's just start really writing. But honestly, like the vomit draft is so, so important because what we really do is we'll split it up or not. But the real relevant part of it is like really a no judgment shit draft where it's like, I want to have 90 to 100 pages of script in like 3 or 4 days.
Just to see if the story holds water. So we break it out first, we outline it, and then it could be, you know, if a joke comes to you, great, but you don't get hung up on it. If a great bit of dialogue comes up, great. But if it just comes down to a character speaking their drive.
Their first level dialogue of just that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm feeling really hurt right now. And so this is me lashing out at you because I really can't. You know, I don't know how any other way to convey my emotions. So I'm being an asshole to you.
It could really be blunt garbage. And to us that I've found really is so valuable because I certainly feel like writing is rewriting. And that is just so deeply true that it's easier to rewrite a bad 90 page script, a very bad 90 page script than it is to like write from complete scratch. And so
It gets you out of the mindset of perfection, which I think is kryptonite for a lot of writers is like that it needs to come out of you fully finished in a way. And this way it's just like, no, this is going to suck. By design, it is a script that you will not hand to anyone else, but it will be a teaching lesson to let you know if the story holds weight, if the movie is moving, if the story is moving in a way. Obviously there's different kinds of movies and everything, but in general, even art films, like, you want a progression, you want the story to build. You don't want to have a lot of scenes that you could just pull out and would mean nothing, and it wouldn't affect the plot or the.
It becomes pretty clear even in that vomit draft when the plot is meandering, or when you're repeating a beat
that happens quite a bit. You'll read it and be like, "This is the same beat. This is the same emotional movement in the arc." And then
just having that draft with zero judgment, and especially as a writing team, it's great because you're like, "Here, this is the scene," and like. Because you have not put any ego in it, you take no umbrage at criticism.
Yeah, I love that.
And that's such a hard part of writing, even just with yourself. You write it down on paper and you've attached your ego to it, where it's like, this is good. It's good. I think it's good. Because you're basically saying by writing a real scene, I think this is good. And it's really important to not attach that ego so early in the process. It's such a work in progress. It's such a wet clay still that like, it's much easier to both receive criticism from a writing partner or just yourself by having this vomit draft. And so anyway, so vomit draft is done. And then we start really assigning that work, but now we have something to note, which is really good. Where it'd be like, hey, like, all right, this is not good. That's not working. Let's really try to hone in on that. And we'll
either go scene by scene or like chunks, a couple scenes or an act. But yes, like, because we have this vomit draft, there'll be notes on it and we'll talk to each other before and be like, just keep an eye out for this. This feels like an area where we could easily find ourselves, you know, stuck in the mud on this thing. And so you have a little bit of direction going in, then you write it, we send it to each other. We either give notes on it and send it back, have a discussion about it, send it back. If one of us is being like, I'm feeling lost on this scene, and the other person may be like, I really feel like I have a way to crack this. The other person might take it then.
Yeah. And I mean, the truth is, and then again, we just do this over and over and over. Every scene, we functionally have a little writer's room between us. Every scene is rewritten and polished and worn over a dozen times before I would ever consider it even like a functional script that I would show to people other than like internally. And that to us is like part of what makes a script good. It's like every moment from the macro sense to the micro wording has ways to improve it. And you don't have to do it on every pass. A lot of the times we'll break out tracks in our mind. That's what we call them tracks, but that's really just like, okay, this is just the scenes that are about this character's emotional through line for this endpoint for their arc, right?
Yeah,
and it's like,
yeah.
This is where they start, this is where they end. And sometimes, you know, when you're in the morass of 100-some page script, it can get foggy to like have to keep it all in your head. And so sometimes we'll literally just be like, okay, this is just, it's character X and it's his journey from point A to point B. And so I just want those like four mega moments where it's like, I'm actually really hard tracking that. And I want to put them all in a through line of what amounts to a 12 to 15 page script. And I would pop it out. And then we just work on that. And suddenly the tracking becomes very clear and easy. And you're just like, yeah, okay, this is where he was on page one. And this is where he is in the middle. And this is where he is in the end. And all of the other things, all the other plates that are spinning over the course of the movie are not there at that moment. You're just like, it's just these things. And then you pop them back in and you polish them around. But that's certainly another like tool that we end up doing quite a lot for like character work and emotional tracking. And then it's just like that final punch pass where you're just.
We usually get back into the room to turn the key together for a couple of days to go through it. We'll each do a punch pass, but then we'll bring those punches together and put it up on a big screen maybe, and just like go through page by page.
And then those jokes, some jokes go in, some jokes you're like, oh, it's like this. And then we'll riff on the jokes, and the jokes all get better when you're like workshopping them together. And you know, that's part of the joy of comedy.
And this is also why, like, I, I much prefer writing with a partner, especially a feature, which is just an albatross to move and to improve on. And it's why another reason why I say find your people, because if you don't have a partner, we also have our people too. And it just so happens that our people, the people we came up with, a lot of them are working writers now, but they weren't when we met them. They were, you know, and so one mistake I see happen is, you know, people will send Dan and I scripts, and we both try to help young writers out and read, you know, and if it's a, you know, your mom's, you know, Pilates instructor's daughter or whatever. And I really,
but we're really supportive. She should keep going.
Yeah. I really, really shut down when I get a script that I'm reading something that hasn't been proofed. I'm reading something that is just like very first thought that I know that this is the first draft of. I shut down really a lot, and I feel like a little bit taken advantage of. So this is to writers out there. It's like, find your people. If you don't have a team and you're not rewriting a lot, you got to be going back and forth and being like, is this really great? Because when you get someone's eyes that could help you in your career, you better make sure that you've done the work.
And I would also say that, like, that to me is like the value of, regardless of like outside. And it's why talking about our performance background is so meaningful to us too, still, because we would do table reads with our friends of the scripts we'd write. Mm-hmm. And like nothing, that was as valuable as anything we would ever do in our writing process. We would write a screenplay. We'd get a bunch of our friends who are actors together, comedians, and we'd just sit down and read it out loud. And, you know, and that became the same lesson when we started writing in sitcoms a lot. That's the process. You do a table read for every episode, and that's standard. And then you do major rewrites off of those table reads, because the moment you hear something out loud, the moment outside eyes are on it, your shame sets in, and you need that shame to be like, this sucks. Oh, I can't believe I let anyone see this crap. I'm a fucking moron. And suddenly the answers become way, way clearer, because you can actually put aside like the ego of the first thing you wrote being brilliant and be like, oh, of course that's not why it's not working. Of course that's what it needs here. And suddenly these things become really obvious because you heard it out loud, and suddenly it's a movie again. And it got out of your head and into the outside world. And so to us, that's and you can get that from a good set of eyes on a read. You don't have to do table read, but table reads are awesome if you can ever get them together. Yeah. You'll learn so much.
You have to at least get eyes on your script before it goes out. If you're taking your swing on things, even if it's going to a film festival, especially, you know, or like a get eyes on it and develop relationships with people who have similar taste and have different taste, you know, because that's also being able to take a note is a skill in this business. You know, there's a note, yeah. you might, and it's really difficult, but you know, there's the saying, what's the note behind the note, which is you get a note and you're like, that's a dumb note. That's make them better at their job. You know why, you know, and you're like, that's such a stupid fucking note. But what are they really saying? They're saying, I don't feel like I can root for this character. I'm having a hard time, like, and then suddenly you're like, now you're having a meaningful discussion. Is there anything that, am I making this character, not giving the audience a way in to root for this person, in a way that's coming across? So, you know, like even bad notes have a good note behind them some of the time, not always. Sometimes they suck, but
even the bad ones, I mean, look, that's why you wish you had a translator, because sometimes all the executive is saying is like, hey, like, marketing needs to have this particular thing in the commercial.
We want a dog that pees on our guy's leg, because that's just going to be funny. And you're like, no. but I'm saying even before that, like in the pro, like that's a great problem to have if you're like production is talking about like, this needs to pop more. But even when talking to your friends, hearing notes, you know, even notes from people who don't read scripts, there's usually something to be gained from it.
Anyone who watches TV or movies and is a fan of TV and movies, like, can give real notes. I mean, that's the bottom line. Like,
you have to take all of them, and you shouldn't, but if
they're feeling bored in a section, like, or if they're not tracking something, those are real notes. Like, you never have to take someone's solution, but you should always listen to what's falling off the track for them. Like, where are they not getting something? And that is your responsibility as the writer, because ultimately you're hoping that an audience is taking your meaning. If they're not taking your meaning, then you are failing.
I absolutely agree. If you hand your work over to a friend who is not sophisticated in the world of storytelling and they say, I didn't really like this part so much. And you say, why? And like, I don't know. It just was kind of meh. That's still a note. That's a note.
That's a valuable note.
Yeah.
That's a valuable note. You don't have to, exactly. Like, and they might give you a solution that's fucking terrible.
Oh, and they probably will. Yeah.
They probably will. Yeah. You don't have to take that, but you should earnestly listen to like, oh, what? I wonder why they fell off in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with what you're saying about the value of table reads. Bailey and I have been involved in a few, including one of Bailey's screenplays. And man, does that transform things very quickly. Because I think a lot of writers think, oh, it'd be neat to hear my work read aloud. Like, no, no, no.
It's a horror show.
Yeah. Everything is different and you don't need to have the best actors. You don't. But man, when those words are coming out of people's mouths, everything changes quickly. And for a project that's reached a certain level of maturity, I can't imagine a faster way to learn about where you actually are and how you actually feel about your own work.
Yeah. I mean,
also hearing scene direction out loud, I find to be incredibly illuminating because you can get very caught up in the very flowery long prose and you're just like, man, this is, you'll as the writer will feel it when the page turns and you're like, oh shit, this is 3/4 of a page of just scene direction. You're like, oh god, oh god.
Oh yeah, there was a table read where I was doing the action lines and at some point somebody leaned in and said,
skip it,
could you maybe just remove 3/4 of everything?
Like, yeah,
that
is the experience of the reader too, like, yep. Well, you want it's certain things need to be described, but how do you do it in a you know, economical way? Because you do want the person reading it to turn pages, to look at it and be like, fuck, this story is moving. Because it's hard to get people to sit down and read. Yeah. I wish it were easier. Yeah. It's hard.
And again, that's, I mean, the more your script can resemble the experience of seeing a movie, which is just sitting back and just being like, ah, it's coming into my face. And that's all I want. And you want the experience of reading to functionally be the same thing, which is like, we're looking for them to just be turning the page as if they're watching a movie. It's at that speed. And it's, you know, it shouldn't be more difficult than that. Even stuff where like there are questions, it's hard, it's complicated. You want them leaning in the way that they're like, huh, what's this? It's interesting. You know, it's the same experience. And that should be the goal.
Yeah. And that's something that we kind of always knew that, but I think that's something that Akiva really drilled in, at least in my head, was just like, we'd write things and then we'd come back and read the scripts, the full thing. And it even started with Rescue Rangers, but definitely a Naked Gun. And we'd have a weekend read and it'd be like, when did it start feeling like a real movie for you? Like, and Akiva would be like, it didn't start feeling like the movie was happening until, you know, page 9. He's like, you know, like, then I felt like I was like, ah, I'm in the movie. Like, and it, I was like, it's not just the inciting incident, but it's just like, I feel, you know, or I feel like I'm in good hands. I feel like I am being guided in a movie and I'm in the movie right now.
It's also to me, the lesson of becoming an editor. And, you know, that's something that making your own work, filming things is probably the most valuable part. And obviously we got to do that as producers in TV where there's a ton of editing, but the thing that you register all the time in reading scripts versus watching movies is like the beginnings of scripts are so dense. They're so overly complicated sometimes. And to Doug's sort of point of just like, when did it feel like I stopped having to like figure this out? Like in a movie, you're just like, you're just enjoying the thing that you're watching and it's pretty clear very quickly. And, you know, that's certainly a lesson of both as an editor, taking that editing lesson into writing, just like how much less do I need to say? How simple can it be done? How quickly and simply do things need to be said and then not repeated? Repetition is something that is as a writer, you're like, I want it to be really clear. I want everyone to understand what I'm saying. And so I'm going to say it 8 times. And then an editor will be in the edit and see that you've said it 8 times and be like, they do not need to say it 8 times. They can say it 1 time because the audience is absorbing it. If it's said clearly the first time, they got it. You do not need to keep saying it.
Look, the reverse to that is if you get into the business and you're breaking in, you'll get bad notes where it'll be like, I need to hear the character say that out loud again. And you will. And there are plenty of times when Dan and I have been like, we're writing something that is going to be cut if this movie ever gets made. This is going to be cut. Sometimes we try to put it into the scene direction where we like the line is just like, this really lands on him.
Oh, okay.
Those are just classic bullshit for an executive kind of.
But hopefully that means writing, hopefully that means you're already in the door. And at that point, you know, when you're writing it and showing someone you have a good grasp of it, you know, I talk about this a lot and we can move on, but I do go on Script Slug all the time and try to read scripts and just see. I was like, and I just read the first 15 pages of The Departed is a great fucking read. And you're like, oh shit, they're not holding my hand at all. I am just moving through these scenes and they expect that I will get it. And you do. And you're reading and you're just like, oh man, this is fucking glorious. It is fast and it's exciting immediately. And then you watch that movie and that's how it feels. You're like, I am shot out of a cannon in this story in a way that is so, you feel like you're in great hands. And that's what a great filmmaker does. And that's what a great screenwriter does.
How was the studio on this project? Was there much pushback? Were there a lot of notes on this, or did they come to you knowing that you were the guys to give them what they wanted? Was it tidy?
I think that all told, this was a very smooth process. There was a lot of momentum immediately because Liam wanted to do it. And I'll say again, like Akiva works a little bit differently, but because our audience at Paramount was so excited about the prospect of this, we had engaged executives and Akiva would send along pages pretty early on. He'll be like, hey, we're moving.
Just scenes or sections.
The first 15. And it worked brilliantly with this movie because you got a sense immediately that like they liked the direction we were going. The worst thing is you spend 3 months on a movie that you're writing in a cave and you send it to them. And immediately by page two, they're like, this isn't what I wanted. Like, and you're fucked. And that's maybe not your fault. So in this movie, Akiva had a very fluid relationship with Paramount and with Fuzzy Door. So we didn't get smacked down with like where we had to throw away an entire script ever. So it was, you know, here's what we're thinking. Here's this, you know, here's the general idea for our villain. And then here are some big comedic set pieces. And so that allowed for a way smoother relationship between, you know, writers and the executives at Paramount. So I'd say it was, in our experience, pretty smooth, but there's always notes and there's always things you disagree with. And there's always, you know, we kept getting this one note about caring about like Frank Moore and.
The funny thing is like, obviously the Naked Gun is a particular movie. Spoof movies are a particular form in that like they're sillier, they're lighter. They're just less sincere than most movies. And so sometimes we would get notes that felt very much like plucked from a standard movie playbook where it's like, why is this movie not more about Frank and his father's, you know, Frank and his father's relationship and how he's trying to impress his father. And like, there were sometimes notes that felt like they were trying to dig in too deeply, where it's just like, that's not what this movie is. Like, we don't want to get so deep that this is something. But the fun thing that we found is we would get these notes. They're very sort of like what felt sometimes maybe like very standard notes, nothing wrong with them, but a little missing the forest for the trees on the project. And we would do what is the ultimate assignment of Naked Gun, which is, well, how do you spoof the tropes, right? And so in a great way, we would get certain notes that felt like tropey notes. And we would just be like, okay, well, what's the stupid version of actually answering your note? And, you know, case in point in this movie is like, we have this runner of him talking, asking to see an owl and his dad being an owl. And that truly is, and we had another large beat of it in the middle of the movie too, that ended up getting cut eventually. But it was, but that's fully just like getting this note from the studio being like, we want to really invest in his relationship with his father. And, you know, what does it mean to be like, an intergenerational family with struggling with these same emotional issues? We're like, yeah, I mean, that's not this movie, but we'll do the stupid version of that. And so like, and that's a case in point of like us taking a note that we were like, I don't know if this matters, and being like, all right, no, let's embrace it. Let's run with it. We're going to actually do this storyline. And now it's going to be the sort of stupid version of it.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Because if you're getting notes that the story's not being sincere enough about this, well, that's kind of the point, is it's not sincere right. Anything.
That's exactly.
What we're doing here.
Right.
In tackling a good old-fashioned, in air quotes, spoof like this, that to my knowledge hasn't been done in a while, were you consciously concerned about whether younger audiences today were going to know how to watch this movie. You're going to know how to think about it. Because I am reminded of back when Police Squad, the series, was first on TV. They had problems with it because it was so sincere about being so dumb that audiences then in the middle of prime time didn't know what the fuck to make of that show. And were you worried about that kind of coming around? Because it's been a little while since the last Naked Gun movie.
I mean, we obviously, as people who grew up obsessed with the form of spoof movie. You know, we believe in it. We believe in its essence as something inherently hilarious. We did not need an education on it the first time we saw one of these movies. Nevertheless, you know, you're correct in that, like, we would do test screenings for this movie as we were, like, developing, you know, an edit. And we certainly found that, like, people under a certain age for the first 5 minutes were confused. They're like, what the fuck is happening here? They're like, you know, does he have superpowers? Are his fingers a magical gun? Is that going to come back? Stuff where it's like, no, this is a cartoon. There's no permanency to the jokes. They just move along. And so there was a certain amount of education that had to happen within the movie itself. I think people learned how to read it, but thankfully marketing did a great job and blanketed the world with advertisements. So thankfully, I do think that we were able to jump over that problem via marketing and ads and all the stuff on socials. So as writers, no, we never felt the need to educate within the movie how a spoof movie works. Because again, even the worst case scenario where we were doing these testings and it took a couple minutes for people under a certain age to understand, it still just took a couple minutes, and then they were just as into the movie as anybody else. And so, no, I again, like, the it's a self-contained sort of tone, and once you sort of get on the escalator, you're riding.
Who is responsible for the snowman sequence? I was not expecting a fever dream montage in the middle of this movie.
I mean, we knew we had to do a love montage, and no one knocked it out of the park more than the first Naked Gun. The two of them falling in love, full body condoms. I believe it's platoon. they're leaving platoon and they're in hysterics. It's just one amazing joke after another, totally turning the love montage on its head. So we had talked early on about, we're never going to top that. We shouldn't try to top that. We're not trying to. I talked about the horror movie genre.
Of wanting to zag away from it, like really like
zag away from something and really like take a swing. But I will say that, you know, Dan and I woke up to a text from Akiva, you know, in a fever dream. He basically wrote this snowman montage, which is from the first draft, basically a lot of what you see, you know, with maybe a couple other things that we pulled out or, you know, gilded the lily on a little bit. But that is the genius of Akiva Schaffer, the snowman scene. When you have a running partner, sometimes they just make you look real smart. He sent it over. And the smart thing we did was like, yeah, that's the funniest thing we've ever seen. And that was an area also where like we had to fight for that's, you know, in classic filmmaking, that scene does not need to be in the movie for the story to work. So so when you're low on, when you're over budget, it's, you know, that's the unfortunate thing that like, you know, a line producer might say, well, we got to cut this. It's just stupid. They don't get it. But that was something that we all, and Akiva very much so, dug his heels in and were like, no, this has to be shot. And that was something we were fighting for the whole time and have. It's one of the great versions where we were vindicated almost immediately because it's so
funny. And good.
Yeah, it's one of those sequences that I find delightful too because, oh, this is a funny surprise. And then it's going on a little long and then it wraps around and it's funny all over again because of how committed and how far it's going.
It's an entire standalone story.
Yeah.
It's really fun. Yeah.
And that also, again, in a pacing level also became like a clear necessity too, where we realized that we were at a moment in the movie where while, you know, everything was already really funny, that we'd been living very much in the tone and pacing of the original movie and your expectations of that. And even if you didn't know the originals, like we'd already educated you enough on this is what it feels like, this is what it seems like. And the bits all sort of follow that template. And so a really just important part of comedy is just staying ahead of the audience and surprising. And so it certainly at that moment, it has reached a tempo peak where we need to switch. We need to move to a new type of joke, a new type of comedy, something that you're not expecting, so that you stay sort of in this elevated leaning forward space where you're just like, what's going to happen next? What's this? And so, you know, it serviced a lot of really important parts of the movie, just both being hilarious, but also that it's different, weird, and unexpected in that moment has extra added value.
I had this guy beside me, just, he could not contain himself. He was just fucking going crazy. It was fantastic. Do you think,
I love it,
with the success of The Naked Gun, and I know we have like Scary Movie 6 was announced and stuff like that. Do you think we're going to see the spoof genre make a comeback?
I hope so. I mean, I think as with everything, like, it's about the work. It's like, you know, if it's funny, then it's going to be great. And I'll go see it. I hope it does well. I can't predict the box office per se, but I love these movies. A funny movie is a funny movie. And so if the next Scary Movie is funny, I'll go see it. If the next Spaceballs is funny, I'll go see it.
It's all about the economics of it. I think that, like, you know, I wish that the reception for Naked Gun has been, could not have asked for a better reception. Like, critics liked it and people love it. You know, it didn't knock the fucking doors off the box office. And I was hoping it would for that reason, because there's, you know, it's very easy to say comedies don't do that. And I think that Naked Gun will do well, you know, on demand. So I'm hoping that it did enough for people to be like, no, let's keep trying these out. And like, it's just kind of all about also keeping the budget down, which is, you know, they're not going to make what a Mission Impossible makes. They're not going to make us, you know, what a Marvel movie makes. It's not going to be that. But if they can turn a profit, I think what Naked Gun is showing us right now is at least that, like, at least in the conversations we had, is like, there are a lot of people rooting for this. And there are a lot of people in the industry rooting for this movie to do well, which has been uplifting. Like, people are, there's a breath of fresh air that people seem to be, you know, exhaling right now, that like, this happened.
Yeah.
So I'd say that has been good. There's so many bleak things we can focus on in the business, in the world, but people really want Naked Gun to work. So I hope so. I hope that Josh gets to make a great movie with Mel Brooks, who is, you know, I hope Spaceballs comes out. Personally, I'm dying for it.
Oh God. It was Naked Gun and Spaceballs were our just two favorite movies as kids.
They absolutely of all time.
Set us on the course of our lives to becoming comedy writers.
Yeah, love that.
Maybe this is too tropey of a question, but given the state of the industry right now, would you have, either of you have any advice for up and coming comedy writers who are trying to get some attention to their work right now? Is there anything in particular someone could be focusing on?
I mean, my personal feeling is we came up in the first wave of YouTube sketch comedians. And, you know, my personal feeling about as far as like comedy, it's everything we were saying in the beginning, which is like, there's never been a better time to be making your own stuff. You know, YouTube is not just more popular, but it's monetizable. And TikTok is the most popular platform in the world. If you are looking to make comedy and develop your voice for comedic ends, like, those are the best platforms in the world to develop your voice. And you actually can make some money doing it, which is hard. It's only gotten easier to do on those platforms. I deeply, deeply encourage you to go make things. You'll learn more making things for yourself than anywhere else, just, you know, sitting and writing. So, like, I actually think it's as good a time as it's ever been to be a young comedian trying to figure out a space.
It's very hard, but go out and make shit, I think, is the answer. In terms of, like, you should be looking to write XYZ, that's a really slippery slope. I think that you should first write what speaks to you, because that's going to be your best work. You can say, like, hey, look, people are always looking for a romantic comedy. I think they are too. But, like, it's still idea-based. If you got to, like, when you're trying to break in, I would look for the things that feel like clean pitches. I just think it's, you know, like, just something you can be like, this is the premise of this movie. I do think that's helpful. It allows for people to take something and be like, oh, if you know an assistant somewhere and be like, hey, my friend's got this great idea where, like, you know, you drink this potion and suddenly everyone loves you, but you know, but you can't love them back if they think you're cool, but whatever, like whatever the law.
Yeah. Whoa, Doug, did you just come up with that on the spot? Damn.
No, boy, you better get that over to WGA immediately.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Direct line. We got to go, guys. Write what you want to write, Doug.
And I also say that like something I see a lot with young writers when like, if they send me something like, the problem I always find with young writers is that they are avoiding their own voice to try to like placate like what they think a market is.
Yes.
And that like the most important thing you could do when you're starting your career as a writer is identify like what you are passionate about, what you think is interesting personally, and what you can speak to personally, because that is the only thing that will actually shine through. The idea that you're going to, no offense, Doug, find like, oh, this is my love potion number 9. Like, I actually don't think it's to your benefit to be looking for the most commercial things at the beginning of your career. I actually think it's to your benefit to be looking for the most personal things, because that actually is the thing that makes you unique and interesting and therefore like marketable to a larger.
I think both things are true. I agree. Don't go chase the thing that you think people want. But what I will say is you have a great piece of writing. You're going to work on your writing sample. When you get in the room, having ideas is helpful, is being like, because it'd be like, yeah, this is great. We're not going to make this movie. This is a fucking great idea. And then if you're like, well, I had this fucking love potion number 9 idea, then you're talking then. And that's what I would say. I agree. You don't want to, don't be false. Don't try to like predict the industry. Be yourself, have an authentic voice. But if you have a take on something, these ideas are worth something, because there will be conversations where someone will say, hey, but we're really looking for something for Glenn Powell. And you'll be like, fuck, what the fuck do I have for Glenn? Oh, you know what? I had this idea. And at least keeping the conversation going from a business standpoint is helpful. So both things are true.
Yeah.
I also think earlier when you said find your people, I think like just the way both of you came up, your persistence, you guys tried every acting, table reads, doing your own short films, writing plays, and networking with other people, writers who weren't staff or paid writers at the time, and now they are. You guys just surrounded yourself with those kind of people. And I think, yeah, it took 8 years to get Chippendale made, and it took a long time to get to the Naked Gun and maybe where you wanted. But it just goes to show like the persistence and finding your people and your voice. And I think your journey is very inspiring.
Thank you. Once they let you in, don't let them push you out.
Yeah, that's why I think have your pitches ready too, because I could feel that at the beginning of our career. Once they open the door, I'm like, they're not fucking closing this thing on me. No fucking way. I am not leaving here until I pitch, until I'm blue in the face and there's blood coming out of my ears. I'm not going anywhere.
Once I'd say this is the thing I say to every young writer, which is like, once you make the commitment that you're in this for the long haul, just get used to and comfortable with failure and rejection. Because there is no business in the world where you will experience more rejection than working as a writer in Hollywood. At every single level, every idea you have will be told it is stupid and will not work over and over and over again until something works.
And this is where your people come in, because you need this support system.
Yeah.
So true.
Beautiful advice. Thank you guys for coming in and for being so forthcoming on so many details about your craft and your approach to things. And it's evident why the two of you are so effective working together. Congrats on your success. Really appreciate your time today. And you probably can't answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Any word on a sequel to Naked Gun?
We've had a lot of conversations with the producers, the studios, the stars, everyone's interested, but we're all waiting on
Bob artistically Puffers. People are interested. Yeah. We don't, that's what we could say. You know.
Oh, it's out there, Doug.
I think people would, you know, they got to figure out if it makes sense for them. But yes, we have notepads with jokes.
Well, I hope you guys get to tackle it. I'm sure it'll be great, as this one was. Thanks again, guys. And we'll hope to talk with you again after your next project hits the street, or anytime you just need a platform to rant about something, just let us
Thank
know.
Thank you.
All right. It's been a pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
Hey guys, appreciate talking. Thank you guys.
Right. Thanks, Dan. Thanks Doug.
Bye.
Bye guys.
Bye-bye. If it makes sense, Dan and Doug seemed, dare I say, excited to nerd out with us. I mean, in there was so much industry insight, and they were incredibly open about the nuts and bolts of what they do. a lot of really practical advice in there. I mean, really actionable stuff. Some advice that I'll take to heart, no doubt. And also some special gems in there, specifically if comedy's your thing, but plenty of what they had to say applies to any genre or any kind of writing you might be doing.
I mean, I just love their mentality as writers, how they think about it. And I love how they approach the craft of it, especially when they said to us towards the end there, I told myself, once I get in that room, I'm not fucking leaving. You have to, you're going to have to slam the door on my fingers to get me to leave. Now that I've been, you know, I've been given a shot in Hollywood, you're going to have to burn the place down to get me out of here. And I love that kind of mentality because I think it's really needed.
Once you get into the room, be tenacious about it and have something in your hip pocket to talk about when they inevitably don't want to talk about the thing that you're there to talk about.
Absolutely. Have a backup plan.
Have a plan B and a plan C and a plan D and keep talking till they kick you out.
Something that's very important for writers to do. Maintain your own heat. Make your own heat.
Yeah. So much good advice in there. I couldn't be more appreciative. And with that, a big final thanks to our guests this episode, writers Dan Greger and Doug Mand. And thanks as well to Story Summit for making this podcast possible. To meet other writers, turbocharge your craft, and learn about career opportunities writers care about, it really doesn't get any better than the generous people at Story Summit. Please take a moment to check them out now at storysummit.us. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep writing, and if writing is your career goal, please keep in mind, as our guests today pointed out, that you'll be told no more than you care to hear, but please don't give up, because all it takes is that one yes. I've been your host, Brian Landwehr. This episode produced by myself and Bailey Patterson, with the support of David Paul Kirkpatrick of Story Summit.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Original music by Kenton Edward.